In an ordinary Sydney suburb, a family lives unnoticed.
You came across so innocent.
Father and son keep mostly to themselves.
We didn't go beyond the friendly nod or hello.
But behind closed doors...
Something's gone wrong, big time.
If you don't make phone calls, nobody can tap you.
A new three-part series investigates how the road to Bondi began long before the first shots rang out. The Road to Bondi. Search Background Briefing wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You get to describe yourself however you'd like to be described.
Oh, okay. Gorgeous, young. Can I make it a dating application?
We're here to take you inside courtrooms. But more often than we'd like, there's things that we can't tell you about, things the court bar us from mentioning for months, sometimes for years. And in this episode, we find out why, and if that system is working. I'm Stephen Stockwell. Welcome to a special episode of The Case Of.
His lawyer argued that his client's name should still be suppressed out of concern for his mental health.
He's now appealing his conviction, but the suppression order banning his name in the press caused outrage.
It is important that the justice system does strike the right balance here.
The suppression order was the worst in living memory.
Judge Andrew Palmer said the secrecy couldn't last forever and that he needed to face the consequences of his actions.
We have had so many emails asking us why we're not allowed to tell you everything that happens inside a courtroom. And when we've got what are described as open courts, that is a very fair question to ask. So we wanted to answer it for you. To do this, we've invited someone with a huge amount of experience onto The Case Of, a woman who jokingly referred to herself as the queen of banning things, but who more recently has been very critical of a high-profile suppression that we've spoken about on the pod. This guest is a former Supreme Court judge, Betty King. To start with, what should I call you? Your Honour, former Justice, where do we sit? Betty's fine? Great.
Betty's, that's my name.
Great. Thank you, Betty. Really appreciate you coming in, having a chat with us about all of this. There's a bit I'm keen to chat through, you know, how the process works, why the process works in certain ways, the problems with the suppression process. But what I'm really interested in starting with is whether or not you think at the moment the suppressions process is properly balancing the need and desire for open justice and the kind of judicial process. Is it working?
I'd have to say I think in most aspects it's working. There is a new area that has opened up, and that relates to the mental health of the accused person. The Act, I don't think, was ever intended to cover that, but it has been viewed as doing that, and as a result, some fairly high-profile people have been able to use that section about protection of any person to include themselves being named because it might have adverse effects upon their mental health.
I'm really keen to talk about this. I think the idea of, you know, the adverse mental health impact of someone who's been charged with a serious crime, you know, I think anybody who's been charged with a serious crime is going to be dealing with some pretty adverse mental health impacts, right? So
if they haven't got some adverse mental health impacts, there'd be something wrong with them.
Yeah.
So it's whether or not it goes to such a level in these particular cases that it warrants or merits a suppression order. And that would have to be a fairly high standard for me.
I mentioned in the intro for this that you've jokingly referred to yourself as the queen of banning things. Why? Where did you get that title from?
Well, I was doing the gangland trials, and which were a series of continual one after the other trials relating to Carl Williams. And as a result, there were many suppression orders required because what we wanted to do was to get the trials actually running. And if you'd read that Carl Williams had just been convicted of a murder and you say, right, ready for the next one, try finding a jury that could deal with that and just put what they'd immediately heard out of their mind.
Yep.
So I granted suppression orders to stop him being the subject of so much publicity. It was like he was a superstar.
And is that the kind of the broad purpose of a suppression order, to kind of make it easy for a jury to kind of keep that information out of their mind when they're assessing the facts that are presented in whatever trial it is that they're overseeing and judging?
The suppression orders have a number of purposes. That was the purpose of mine in the Carl Williams matters. But there are many other purposes for suppression orders. The main thing is that we want the trials to run, to proceed, to get completion. if we don't have completion, these people sit in jail for too long. And then if they sit in jail for too long, they're entitled to make an application for bail. And often it might have to succeed. If they're 3-4 years unconvicted, then you've got to really seriously consider bailing them.
Yep.
So it's for the community that you want the trials to proceed.
Right. In the trial of Aaron Patterson, there was evidence that came up in the pre-trial of that we weren't able to talk about during the trial, and in some cases was even suppressed following the trial's conclusion and through an appeal window. And when we were able to talk about that, the audience was, you know, in some sense kind of outraged that we weren't able to discuss that, or that the jury didn't hear some of that information during the trial. Why is that done? Why does that happen?
They're two quite different things. A suppression order is suppressing information that would ordinarily be heard by a jury or be public to the jury. An order such as you're talking about is there has been legal argument, the judge has excluded some evidence, and if you make it public, then there is no point in excluding it because the jury will read it, hear it or see it. So it's automatic that the media understand they cannot ever publish what goes on in a court in the absence of a jury.
Yeah. And we're really fortunate here at the ABC, certainly with the case, I've got some fantastic lawyers that help us when we're working through episodes, making sure we're not breaching that and not jeopardising a trial, basically, by promoting something or publicising something that the jury shouldn't hear.
It's an expensive process to run a trial. And if we have to run for 3 weeks and 4 weeks, and then somebody reports something that blows the whole system, and you've got to start again, that's money that costs the community.
Yeah.
And it also makes it terribly difficult for witnesses to have to give evidence more than once. So there are many factors. But the most important thing is two different aspects, two totally different things. No one in any jurisdiction reports what goes on in legal argument until the trial is over.
When you're looking at suppression orders, you mentioned witnesses there. I mean, what can be at stake with a suppression order? How important are they?
Well, in the Ganglands, for example, I put two permanent suppression orders on. And the names of these two people are suppressed forever. And that's simply because they rolled over and gave evidence against Williams and others. And in the world in which they were, they all both got sentenced to jail and long terms. But they would be, in all likelihood, murdered in jail pretty quickly if people knew what their names were. And so that's what you try and stop. You actually don't want people being murdered.
Yeah. I mean, the suppression order is kind of one side of it. It stops the media talking about it. But courts are kind of open to anyone to wander in as well and sit in the back and observe. Like, you know, is there a mismatch there between someone being in a courtroom and being able to hear this stuff and then tell their friends about it? And, you know, a suppression order, is there some tension and difference there?
No, I don't think there is. The difference is we do have an open court and people can come and watch and see justice being done. What we're preventing is this being on front page of every newspaper for every person to read the next morning. And that's because that's when the jury is likely to become aware of things that they don't need to be aware of.
Yep. On one end, we have the safety of individuals, which is incredibly important, a very noble purpose for a suppression order. On the other end, we had the suppression of Tom Silvani's name during his rape trial and conviction. It was only lifted after he was convicted of rape, 2 counts of rape. Is that a case of someone with means being able to game the system?
I don't know if it's gaming the system, but what you've got is someone who has money, or his parents have money, and they care enormously for their son, I would presume. So they've had him treated by a psychiatrist. The psychiatrist has made a report to the court. The report to the court indicates that he's got serious mental health issues, and if it is made public, then he may be at risk. Now, what do you do as a judge, magistrate, whoever? If you get a report such as that in front of you, do you say, well, no one's challenging it. No one wants to cross-examine the psychiatrist. No one's disputing this. So I should just go ahead and grant the suppression order until the trial's over. It leaves you in pretty much in a no-win situation as the judge, and most would err on the side of caution. But my problem is I think there should be some serious looking at the psychiatric evidence and some proper testing.
And how does that go about? How do you properly test psychiatric evidence? You know, you've got someone there, you've got a young man who says his mental health is seriously impacted. There could be serious impacts if his name is made public. How do you then kind of, I guess, sensitively have the conversation about, well, is it?
Well, the psychiatrist will have put in a report and you would call them and you would cross-examine them. You would speak to another expert psychiatrist. You would ask questions and get information. And you would cross-examine, test whether or not this is something that he's just reacting to what's happened to him, or whether he's had a long underlying mental illness, whether he's been treated before, or is this just arisen now. There are many ways to test expert evidence, because that's what a psychiatrist is giving expert evidence. But if it just goes through untested, you leave the court in a position of just having to accept it.
Yeah, I mean, when you're looking at, you know, the case of Tom Silvani is quite a strong example for us. We've talked about it on the case of, it was covered extensively by ABC News. And when you're, you know, talking about this idea of challenging it, I mean, the news kind of happens pretty quickly. You know, we want to be able to report stuff as soon as it's happening. Is it fair to kind of ask to go through this entire other process to get to a point where you can challenge that?
It takes very short time. You can speak to a psychiatrist, get the information. Most prosecutors and people who are involved, such as media organisations, would have counsel who know about how to cross-examine psychiatrists, what the issues are, what you would look at, how you test it. This would not be foreign material to them. They get the report and a day and a half later or day, 2 days later, in court testing it.
Yeah, right.
Shouldn't be just left as totally unchallenged material unless there is something that makes it so overwhelming.
Mm.
It seems to me that it looks unbalanced simply because the only people who are doing this are people who've got the financial resources to do it. You need to have the resources to be treated by a psychiatrist in private. We're not talking public. You'll wait a long time to see a public psychiatrist. So they have the resources. They've often been put into a psychiatric hospital for a short period of time, and they've got the funds to brief counsel, they've got the funds to pay for the psychiatrist to come to court to prepare a report. All those reports cost money. So it gives a strong appearance of being one rule that applies if you've got money or notoriety, fame, and one if you're just an ordinary person charged.
Yeah. Something that does impress me about lawyers is the ability to find a loophole in these kind of processes. I'm very impressed with the lawyer, like any lawyer's commitment to the rules. I think it's kind of wonderful in a way. They look so closely at these things, and the better or kind of more expensive a lawyer is, the smaller the hole they will find to kind of squeeze through is.
Not always. Not always, but our job as lawyers is to make sure that everything's done in accordance with the law. So you do look at everything. When you look at an indictment, you've got to look to see that the Crown has proved each and every element of the offence. Now, people call it loopholes, but if they've missed one, it's actually not. It's a total failure. It's not a loophole. They have failed to do their job. So, you know, you might call us loophole people, but there's actually a reason for it.
Yeah. I mean, maybe loophole isn't the right word. I think maybe it is technicality may be a better word, but as well. But looking, you know, in the example
it's
of
not
the
technical. missing an element is not technical. It's fundamental. So there are occasionally the technical things, but the way the Act has been drafted, it looks like this mental health aspect can apply to an accused person. It's also equally clear if you go back and look at the material, it's meant to apply to victims and witnesses. But on its face, it reads as though it can apply to the accused. So you can't ignore what it says on its face. So maybe that's technical. But maybe it's just bad drafting.
I think maybe a better term is in the spirit of the rules, potentially.
Oh, we don't do in the spirit of the rules.
And that's what I was meaning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The law's not about, you know, despite what people might think, it's actually not about the vibe.
Yes.
You know, we're not going to go up to the High Court and beat Denny DeNudo and just go, oh, yeah, the vibe, it's the vibe. It's actually about the rules.
Yeah, it is the complete opposite of the vibe.
It is the complete antithesis.
If anything, yeah. And I mean, in the sense of the act that's been used in the case of Tom Silvani is the way to get people working, you know, in the spirit of that law, is that to have these sort of applications challenged and then set that as a kind of process that we can then expect as these applications are made. Is that the best way to solve it?
I would have thought one of the best ways to solve it is to test it properly and take it up to the Court of Appeal. They can give a binding ruling as to whether it applies or not. And I would have thought that would resolve it.
Yep.
I don't know which way they'd go, but I would, you know, my gut feeling is that they would not think this applied to accuse people unless it was exceptional circumstances. Mm. But that's entirely what I think.
Mm.
And if that doesn't work, then just have short, sharp legislative change to exclude. But that takes a long time to get through Parliament. Everything takes a long time to get through Parliament. So I would have thought going up on appeal would be the process.
That's an expensive process, though. You know, it's a indeed, lot for a media company to have to sort of front up and kind of take that weight to fix something that potentially the law should be fixing itself.
The law doesn't act on its own volition. I don't sit there and go, oh, I think I'll do a murder today.
Yeah,
no,
yeah.
We have to have cases brought to us. You know, the court is a repository. Like, you come to us and say, tell us an answer.
Mm.
We can't just give guidance unless someone brings an actual case to us.
Is there an imbalance between the kind of expectation of the media to kind of follow these rules? Tom Silvani, another good example of, you know, no one in the mainstream media was reporting any of that information because of the number of eyes that would have been on us and the penalties that would have been handed down if we breached that suppression. But there were dozens, if not hundreds of people talking about this on social media platforms, on forums. I mean, has it been lost with such free discussion online?
It's hard because this is the main media that you're dealing with in respect of this. It's very hard for the courts, the police, anyone to actually follow all of the social media and find out what is out there. Whereas with, of course, the main media, news shows and television, newspapers, you can find out what's on it because it's easy. And that's also what, if a jury's looking at something or are worried about that, that's what people mainly look at. Gossip has never been able to be stopped. So you can't spend your time concerned about that. But I do think it's going to be a big problem in the future as people get their news from more and more different sources.
Yeah. Should there be steps or processes being taken now to try and stop that? Should there be the prosecution of smaller individuals, basically people running social media pages, to penalise them from spreading that information to try and stop that? Or is there another way we should be approaching it?
Well, I still think most suppression orders work in the main. People did know, some people certainly knew about Tom Silvani after the arrest, after the verdict, but there were an awful lot that didn't. And so he didn't have that same, it was splashed over the front page of the newspaper or leading the 7 o'clock news. And so in terms of impacting his mental health, I would have thought it had done its job. And it, at some stage, it had to be lifted anyway. At some point, it had to come off. And it should have come off, I would have thought, immediately after the trial. And that's what ultimately the trial judge did, just went, this is a nonsense now, and lifted it.
We've got Tom Silvani on one side. There's been a ruling quite recently about whether or not content needs to be taken down ahead of the retrial of accused murderer Gregory Lynn. The judges ruled that it doesn't need to be, that it can remain up. I mean, there was a lot of conversation about what needed to happen there in court. Does that show that the system is working, the process works?
Well, I think it does demonstrate to a large degree that the system does work. What it shows is that the courts aren't oversensitive to people. What they want is to stop the immediacy of something being heard in court, being reported outside, that the jury or the jury about to be impaneled. And I remember when I banned Underbelly and everyone said, oh, it's pointless because, you know, it's going to be available in New South Wales because my jurisdiction stopped at the Victorian border. And I said, it's not pointless because it's not going to be beamed into everyone's lounge room at 7:30 on a Wednesday night. Yes, people will get copies, but they will be a minority. And what you find with Greg Lynn is that happened in the past. It's some time down the track.
Mm.
And you can't stop every bit of adverse publicity about someone.
Mm.
What you can do is try and make it, at the time, the best you can.
Yeah. The thing I found really interesting with in the situation with Gregory Lynn is that, you know, the way that this media was being referred to as being accessible and available and all of that was the same way that media would have been accessible and available 30 years ago. It would have been printed in a newspaper. You can go to the library, you can get the newspaper from 3 years ago if you want. You can have a look at it. So it's still available. I found it interesting that there didn't seem to be that, you know, understanding of how the media had moved and that had changed over the last kind of 30 years. Is that a problem, do you think, that there's been a lack of awareness of the way the media has changed in the last, I mean, really, probably 10 years in the way that we've distributed information and the way that we publish information? Is that causing problems between the media and the bench?
No, I think what causes problems between the media and the bench, with the greatest respect to all of those in the media, is that they want everything. They want every single thing, irrespective of whether it is harmful to a trial that's about to start or is running, or harmful to potentially a witness in the trial. And I understand they want everything, but they just can't have everything. And that's the tension, and it will always be the tension.
Yeah. There was a conversation recently where the judiciary sort of asked the media to kind of trust them. And, you know, that's not really the media's job. Our job's not to kind of trust anyone, really. It's sort of there to hold people account. But to borrow from those words, should the judiciary just kind of trust the media, that we're going to do the right thing, that we're going to release what's relevant and what's important to the public, that's what we can kind of judge fairly within the law?
Well, it's this interesting concept of trusting each other, because neither trusts the other, I'm sure. I mean, I wrote an opinion piece for The Age, and I thought it was reasonably balanced, but the headline bore no resemblance to what was contained in there. It said that I had said Tom Silvani should never have received a suppression order. Nowhere in the article did that come up. So it tends to erode your trust. I mean, I did trial after trial that was in the paper, and I'd just sit there and go, gee, I thought I was in that case. But you wouldn't recognise it from the reporting. So the problem is distrust builds up over time. Mm. But hopefully I think each is a bit more aware of the other's concern now, and I think they're talking and trying to come to some middle ground.
Something that surprised me with some proceedings I've watched in the last 6 months or so is actually the way that, you know, who's sitting on the bench talks about the media. There's been moments where I've seen whoever's at the bench kind of almost in furious agreement with a defence barrister criticising the media for, you know, not understanding the idea of sub judice contempt, which, you know, is the idea that, well, it means that we can't publish anything that's going to prejudice a trial, which, yeah, we do understand. We do have lawyers working with us and advising us on and all of that. And I mean,
but sometimes they do publish some things that you think, wow, who said that was okay? So, and it's pretty frustrating when you're the judge and you're trying to get something up and running and you've been trying for 18 months to get this case on, and then something comes up in the media and blows your chances and off it goes for 6 months. It's just about frustration when these things happen. It's not because people don't like the media, and I'm sure it's not because the media don't like the courts or the judges, but frustration builds on both sides.
And when you say, you know, something blows your chances of having a trial, what do you mean by that? What impact can that reporting have?
Oh, well, for example, they might do something. I'll try and think of it.
Try not to throw anyone specific under the bus?
No. Yeah. I'll try. I could do that easy, but well, you are about to start the murder trial of a murderer of a child by the parent. And 2 days before, there's an article about murders of children, and they used the case that you're about to start as an example. And they include in it things that are probably going to be excluded. The opinions of the other parent, the opinions of the police about whether he's guilty. And all of that, if it's a couple of days or a week before the trial, means you're just going to have to take that trial out, let that publicity die. We know it doesn't go away forever, but it dies. It's not fresh in the mind of the 12 people you're about to impanel. So that's, again, and that happens a lot, or it used to happen a lot in my time. I'm not so sure it does now. I hope it doesn't. But it actually prevents you from running the trial. You've got your whole, like you're booked to run that murder. We don't just do murders. Oh, bring on another murder tomorrow. They are booked months in advance. You block out your time. So you've got to get something else for the judge to do. The prosecutors, the barristers, the witnesses, everyone's lined up and it's all gone. And it's gone because somebody wanted to write something.
You know, in a situation like that, there are a number of levers that are available to a judge leading into a trial. You know, when you're briefing a jury, when you're talking to a jury, giving them direction ahead of a trial, you can say, look, you know, they're all told, don't read the media, don't engage with these things. There's other mechanisms in place. I mean, do you need to hold off like that, or can you trust a jury to make the right decision, to exclude that from their mind?
All right, you exclude from your mind that Carl Williams was convicted of anything. And then tell me your opinion of Carl Williams, just based on all the other facts. No, you don't want them to be superhuman. It is very hard to exclude something that is fresh in your mind. As it goes further away, it's easier. Hmm. It becomes vaguer. Yes, I've read something about this. But as a judge, I used to explain to my juries, not only you can't go and look online and all of this, I'd explain why and just say, you've taken an oath to give it a verdict according to the evidence. If you go read all that stuff, that's not evidence. And you bring it all with you and guess what? You're not being true to your oath. So what should be done more often is explain why you've made a ruling to the jury. I often used to explain why remember we stopped that and I said they can't ask that question? There's a reason for it. And I'd tell them, as if I could, I would tell them why. Because they're not stupid. And if they understand, I think you've got a much better chance of a jury obeying you.
And you know, I think the important thing for people to understand around that is there are such specific rules of evidence of what can be presented in a court, of how someone can be questioned and all of that, that to the ordinary person, you would never consider and you'd never come across in day-to-day life, right?
Oh, no. And I think it's interesting that people think we just make it up. But this is Parliament. Parliament sets the law. And we, as judges, have to follow the law. If we don't follow the law, then there's a retrial or the case is thrown out. We don't have a choice. So we have to follow the law. And that's why I think it's very important that you explain it to them.
Yeah, yeah. You know, we were talking a little bit before about the relationship between the media and the judiciary. Do you think the media understands all those rules and all those laws?
I think depending upon who's listening or who's come to court to report it. It used to be that you had very dedicated court reporters, and they really did understand. We had a lot less trouble. But my understanding equally now is that the county court run programs for new reporters, new court reporters, so they can educate them about what you can and can't do and why. So, I mean, I think that's great on the part of the courts, and I understand why the media don't have the dedicated reporters they had, because it all costs too much money. And everything ultimately comes down to money.
And that's kind of where I come at a lot of this from, is that there's processes to fight suppression orders. There's ways to kind of, you know, try to update the system in the Silvani case where, you know, we can challenge these things. But it's all expensive. It's all money. And, you know, media organisations have less and less of it. Should another party be standing up here and taking some of that on?
And who's going to fund it? Okay, lovely. Let's have an independent who does it. But who's going to pay for it?
Same kind of problem.
Yeah. We don't have, the OPP is starved of funds. The Victorian Legal Aid is starved of funds. What, we'll have this to fight the rich boys and girls? No. It's just ultimately about money. There needs to be a bit more trust, I think, from the media towards judges, because judges are not, in the main, 99.9%. doing this because they believe they have to, you know, according to the law. There'll be always a percentage of every profession, every job that just goes off on a frolic. But hopefully if that happens, they can at some stage be reined in.
But when you're looking at, you know, the purpose of the law, how the law is supposed to serve the people as well, if it's about money, that you, if you don't have people checking this process, you say the law isn't going to check itself. Does that mean that the law is going to stop serving us in the way that it should be serving us?
Well, no. If the media want to report, right, then they need to fight the suppression orders. It's not just, hey, you know, the court should just do it on their own. No, they don't. They act upon the material before them. And it's not the police wanting to publicise the names. It's not the OPP. It's the media.
I was very interested in the county court course you mentioned just before, because I have been reporting on courts now for about a year. This is a very new experience for me, and it's been wonderful to learn so much about all of this. And, you know, something that I've really appreciated learning is how the judiciary works, how judges work, all of these rules, all of these laws, all of this, the whole system, really. What do you think we could do, or what do you think could be done to help kind of repair the relationship between media and the judiciary?
Well, I think, first of all, they need to talk to each other. And my understanding is that there are some committees where they get together. When we had terrible trouble, when I was at the bar, we had terrible trouble between the police association and police generally and the bar. It was really bad. And so we just formed a committee and called it the Pigs and Wigs. And it solved a lot of problems and issues, because we could take something to one of the people on the committee and say, look, this is what happened, and then they could take it to the police and deal with their members. And it was done on a relatively informal basis, and it really helped resolve. And I would have thought, you know, the courts and reporters could get together and just chat about what the problems are, talk about it, don't go to forums, talk about it to each other. The person who can do something about it, both sides, are those people. So I just think a bit of trust would be nice, but no one trusts anyone nowadays, do they? And with AI, how can you?
Exactly, yes. Well, that's it. Well, look, I think that's a nice place to kind of wrap things up. Place we can end is, you know, maybe a bit more trust between everyone. I'm not sure I can see it happening.
I think if the courts and the media got together, there would be a bit more trust. I do think that's a quite viable proposition. They won't end up in a love fest, but I think there would be a better understanding both ways and a better response as a result.
Betty King, thank you so much for joining us on The Case Of.
You're welcome.
The Case Of is produced by ABC Audio Studios and ABC News. This episode was presented by me, Stephen Stockwell. Our supervising producer is Greg Muller, and our executive producer is Claire Rawlinson. This episode was produced on the land of the Wurundjeri people.